Good morning, and welcome to Tech Ed Day 4. Good of you to actually get up. I'm sure most of you were out partying last night. I noticed most of my colleagues who said they're going to be here this morning aren't. My name's Paul Bromley. I work for Microsoft in the UK. I'm aware that most Americans can cope with different accents, but I'm also aware there are people from other countries here where perhaps English isn't your first language. If I do speak too fast, you can't understand me, do raise your hand and I'll try to repeat what I've said. I've worked for Microsoft for 12 years now, a lot of time in real-time communication, and I'm going to talk today about planning for conferencing for Link. What I'm going to cover really is going to look at, think about your requirements for conferencing. Conferencing means a lot of things to a lot of different people, so I'm going to cover some of that. We'll look at some of the conferencing infrastructure. Think about the components within Link, what do you need to think about. Look at how we control some of those features. I'll look at bandwidth planning. Quick show of hands, how many of you were at Brian's session on Tuesday about Link and the network? Okay, just give an indication of how much time to spend on some of that content. And I'll cover a little bit about migration. So when you think about conferencing means a lot of things to a lot of different people. It could be web conferencing. And in with web conferencing, that's generally what we talk about in terms of desktop sharing, document sharing, whiteboarding, and polling. And sometimes some of those features are new to people. Sometimes they're used to desktop sharing, but haven't thought about some of the others. And the way you do conferencing varies. The other area is audio conferencing. A lot of people use dial-in conferencing from service providers. In the UK, we have a company called Bridge Telecom, so BT Meet Me. I've used MCI's conferencing bridge. So people are used to audio conferencing. So audio conferencing and dial-in conferencing, and then there's video conferencing. And it's interesting, video conferencing is the one that scares everybody. They think about bandwidth. But actually, the benefits of video conferencing far outweigh what it takes in bandwidth, and it's not as heavy as people think. So you need to think about these things in terms of what you're going to do for each of them. You also need to think about what sort of conferences. Are they small conferences? Are they large conferences? What do we mean by small? What do you mean by large? I ask some customers and they talk about small conferences being 50 people. That's a large conference. Or a large conference being 1,000 people. Challenging. You need to think about where users are. Remote users, how are you going to satisfy remote users? What about federated users? What about anonymous users? A number of customers I talked to, and I talk about anonymous, and straight away the security people say, no, we're not allowing anybody in like that. And I say, well, why not? You use things like live meeting. Why wouldn't you host that internally? What's the challenge? And talk about some of those issues. And finally, who will conference with who? It's interesting how many customers I talk to, and they say, well, don't I need a server out there? I've got 500 people on that site. And then you start talking about who they will actually conference with. You find most of the reason for conferencing is because they're not on the same site. Generally, if people are on the same site, they actually get up and meet face-to-face. So generally, when you look at conferences, most people aren't actually on the same site. When we look at conference size, these are actually the figures from our planning tool in terms of our profile, but they're based on what we've seen. About 90% of conferences are less than 6 people. So when you start thinking about this and realizing that, conferencing isn't about these big meetings. Now, there may be a need to have those big meetings, but they are few and far between, except for people like the Microsoft Product Group, who tend to have lots of big meetings with lots of customers like you. But generally, there aren't that many big conferences. Because the reality is, 200 people on a conference doing video conferencing isn't the best experience in the world. You actually want to meet in a room like this. So you tend to think about those things. So there are, if you're actually different to those figures, there is a capacity planning calculator. Helps you size things a bit more detail. And if you need to go above 250 users, which is our default maximum limit, there is now a white paper talking about getting up to 1,000 users in a conference. I would recommend you look at the white paper, and then throw it away and don't do it. Why? Because a meeting with 1,000 users in it is not a conference, it's a broadcast. And there are better technologies for doing it, right? We don't multicast, so you've got 1,000 video streams or 1,000 desktop sharing streams going out over your network. You've got to start thinking, planning for that. Not ideal. But if you use something like Media Server with multicasting, you get a much better experience from doing that. So, you know, yes, you can do it, but really think hard before you do. So when we think about where users come from, it's interesting. We actually find only about 50% of the users are internal to a conference. So even though it's 6 people conferences or 5 people conferences, you know, half of them are outside. That's either because they're remote users, like me. I spend a lot of my time working from my home office in conferences. Or because they're anonymous users. They're your customers or your partners you've invited. Or they may be federated users. We federate with a lot of organizations. I spend a lot of my time talking to people in partner organizations. It's federated contacts, federated meetings. Because about half your users are outside, one of the main things you need to think about is your edge, and the one thing everybody forgets about, the reverse proxy. The reverse proxy is a key component of conferencing. Does geography matter? I've said most people aren't in the same location. Could I put just one set of servers in one place and satisfy the whole of the globe? You could, but I wouldn't recommend it. Why? Because there are physical challenges around IP protocols. Latency across the globe and latency effects, audio and video and other things, will impact your conference. Typically what I see is by continent. So the Americas, Europe, Asia, you know, Australia. Three or four data centers. Because if you actually look at it, latency within America is typically around about 30, 40 milliseconds. Latency within Europe is typically around 30, 40 milliseconds. Latency between America and Europe is 90 milliseconds. When we talk about good quality voice, we talk about 150 milliseconds. You can see very quickly you're hitting that sort of limit. Irrespective, not even taking account what's on your internal network. And that's why you need to think about geography sometimes. So if you've got a multinational customer or you're a multinational customer, having conferencing servers in various locations does make sense. But it's purely because of physics, not because of where users are. Now, there will be exceptions. You know, I talk with some businesses that are global, but actually they run as, operate as very independent units. And sometimes it then does make sense to put local servers. But you've got to realize if you put in local servers, you need local edge. As I said, half your users are outside your organization. So it's not just about putting a server out there. So having thought about where we might place servers and who might be in a conference, we need to think a little bit about the client. What client are we going to use for conferencing? There is a lot of choice. There is the great Link client that you get on your desktop. That's great if you're part of the organization. If you're enabled for Link, you're enabled for conferencing. But you may have some part of your organization that are not enabled for conferencing. Or I said those remote users, those people in other organizations. What client are they going to use? There is the Link attendee client. It's a bit like the Link client. The only difference is you don't get a buddy list. But it will do all the same capability. You can all do all the desktop sharing. You can do all the audio video. The downside is it's an install on your desktop, which means if you've got an anonymous user coming in, they may not have rights to install that on their desktop. There's the Link web app. So typically what we see is a lot of organizations, you know, remote outside users, will use the Link web app. It doesn't support audio and video. So you're only going to get the desktop sharing. They will need to dial in to the conference to get the audio. There is the option within the Link web app to get it to call you back. You need to think about whether you enable that, because you're going to bear the cost of that phone call. Do you want to bear that cost? There is the Link Phone Edition. If you go down into the exhibition area, you'll see some of those devices. Some people will call in from the Link Phone Edition. You can see your meetings, you can click on your meeting and say join. And it will join you to the meeting. It's just audio. Great if you primarily do audio conferencing. It isn't going to do any of your desktop sharing, whiteboarding, anything like that. A lot of people will dial in from a phone, be it a mobile, be it a physical desk phone. What's their experience going to be? Again, if you're used to just doing audio conferencing, that's great. It's interesting, I've been doing some audio conferencing with a customer recently, and they organized it on their audio conferencing bridge. And it's surprising how quickly it's like, oh, can't I share my desktop with you? And we had to fire up a meeting, an ordinary meeting. They used Link Web App. It's surprising how often these days you start with audio and you actually want to do other things. But people are used to it. We support it. When we look at migration scenarios, and I'll cover this towards the end, you also need to consider the Office Communicator client and the Live Meeting client and how they play. Are you going to support those or not? What are you going to do in a mixed environment where you've got half your users migrated and half not? I'll cover that towards the end. So here's a very quick comparison of the different clients. You can see the different capabilities. I've mentioned both of them. The only client I haven't mentioned there is Link for Mac. How many Mac users out there? Go on, be honest. Yeah, Link for Mac. Link for Mac, again, has a great set of feature set. You get most of the features. There are a few limitations. But you can do most things. So very much aware of that. If you're using the Link web app, you have to be aware that there is a plugin for desktop sharing if you want to share your desktop. So the person with the Link web app, if they need to share, they need to download the plugin. They can view other people's shares. So what does a conferencing infrastructure look like? Oh, a bit of a blank page, really. What I've put on here is what I've called machine boundaries and process boundaries. Now, although some of those are machine boundaries, some of those processes can sit on the same machine, but they can be separated. There is the conferencing database. Most people aren't aware of the conferencing database. It sits there. If you've got an enterprise pool, it's on your SQL server. What it contains is information about the conference. Who's allowed into the conference? What are the capabilities of the conference? So when you create a conference, based on your conferencing policies, what capabilities are there? Within the server, there are two key components, the focus and the focus factory. The focus factory there is there to help you schedule conferences. So when you click that nice online meeting plugin in Outlook, what it does is it calls the focus factory and just writes an entry into the conferencing database. When you come to join a meeting, you talk to the focus. The focus is the thing that controls the meeting and determines which server within a pool is going to host that meeting. What the focus factory will do is communicate with the different MCUs. So it's not one MCU for everything. There's an IM MCU. There's a web conferencing MCU. There's the app sharing MCU. And there's the audio and video MCU. And the audio and video MCU, if you know, you can have as a separate set of servers. Some other important components that most people aren't aware of. Conference attendant. When you dial that number for dialing conferencing, what answers is the conference attendant? It's what asks you for your PIN and conference ID and looks that up in the conferencing database to find out which conference you're going to connect to and then talk to that conference on your behalf. The conference announcement service is there to announce the fact you've joined or left a conference. So when people join, you get their name and things like that. The personal virtual assistant is a very key component. Most people don't realize it's there. It's the bit that individualizes that phone-in experience of people. It's the bit that gives me my own language. I know in America, you know, we talk about English, but actually there's a lot of Spanish spoken in America, a lot of other languages. I talk to global companies, picking languages, and that's what helps provide that. And then there's a component everybody forgets about, the web components. The join launcher. To join a meeting, it uses a web component. When you click on that URL in your meeting, it's going to launch the join launcher. If we're using the web app, the Reach server provides that web app. The dial-in conferencing page, where you get those numbers that you give you a choice to dial in. So here's a very quick diagram summarizing some of the connections. So scheduling client, the first thing it does is talk to the Focus Factory. The Focus Factory talks to the back-end SQL database. That's how you schedule a conference. The conferencing client, irrespective of which one you use, right? I've missed a little bit out because I said you click on that URL. That URL launches the join launcher. It passes back an actual meeting ID, which then the conferencing client uses to connect to the Focus. The Focus talks, actually, to the conferencing server factory. There's a component on the server that actually knows how utilized the different servers in a pool are to know where to schedule that conference. And then the Focus will then talk to each of those MCUs to spin up the conference in each of those MCUs as you need each modality. And the client will connect directly to those. One thing you'll notice, the client uses different protocols. For IM, it's using SIP. For web conferencing, it's using POTM. Persistent Shared Object Model is what it stands for. For audio video, it's using RTP. For desktop sharing, it's using RDP. So what does a conferencing infrastructure look like? Well, if you look in the documentation, there are three reference topologies. I've just put the most complex one up. That's not to scare you. It's because it has the most detail that I can talk about. And the reason I put it up is because it has two central sites. One of the things I talked about was geography. If you've got a multinational environment, you're going to need more than one central site. Within a central site, though, you have choices. I mean, both of these show the AV separate. They don't have to be. But what they both have got is edge servers. And the reference topology makes the biggest mistake I ever see. It has one reverse proxy in it. If you want high availability, not only does your pool need to be highly available, not only does your edge need to be highly available, but your reverse proxy needs to be highly available. Your firewalls need to be highly available. How many of you just say, oh, give me those firewall ports, please, without any thought about whether that firewall being provided by your organization is highly available? Because if it's not, what's the point of making all this highly available? Come to my session this afternoon. I'm doing one on high availability and disaster recovery this afternoon. But you need to think about these. If you're reliant on other parts of your organization to deliver some of those components and you're providing high availability, what's their service level? Because without that reverse proxy, you can't join a meeting. You can't share PowerPoint. Right? You can't do quite a few things. Because it does it through reverse proxy. External people in your conference, I said about half were external, didn't I? About 10-15% are anonymous, mostly using the Link web app, won't be able to join the meeting if that reverse proxy goes down. When you look at the branch sites, there's nothing on them, or very little on them. There is a PSTN gateway. One of the things you have to think about is when you come to do dial-in conferencing. Are you going to provide local numbers or not? There are pros and cons of providing local numbers. Considerations, geography, I've mentioned that. Concentration of users, that's another consideration. I said, if you have got an independent business using it with a, 500, 1,000 users, and they're going to have, and they can have their own edge, you may want to deploy conferencing to them. But that's unusual. Scale. Separate AV conferencing pool. We talk about if you've got more than 10,000 users on a pool, you should have separate AV conferencing. If you had 10,001, will it still work? Yes. If you had 11,000, will it still work? Well, yeah. Depends on how much capacity you put in your front end, what your exact profile is. Models are just models. They're not exact replication of the real world. What we know is when you get into about 10,000, you're starting to get to the point where you're doing heavy audio-video processing on the server. And it's better to have it separate so you can manage it separately. File share, another component I forgot to mention. File share is another key component of web conferencing. When you upload a PowerPoint presentation, it saves it on a file share. Is your file share highly available? Or have you just said to your network team, give me a file share, without any thought about whether it's highly available or not? Think about your internal and external mix. I've told you it's about 50%. It does vary from organization to organization. And one of the biggest things I see is people using VPN. If you use a VPN, yes, you can do it. Will it work? Well, yeah. Do we recommend it? No. Audio video over a VPN can have issues. Is your VPN scaled for it? What sort of latency is it putting on that audio and video because it's having to encrypt it twice? But if you are using VPN, that's no different to a remote user generally. They're coming into the data center directly. Right? So you need to think about the bandwidth for that. I said internal versus external. Number of times I hear, Edge doesn't matter, we won't put high availability in Edge. And then they realize conferencing becomes a core component of what users are expecting. And suddenly Edge needs to be highly available. Dial-in conferencing. Local numbers are great. This is the Microsoft dial-in conferencing page. These are some of our conferencing numbers. Local numbers are great. We provide them. There's an impact to providing them. If I've got 5 people in Buenos Aires in Argentina, dial-in conferencing is not for 5 people. How many people could they be inviting to a conference? They may invite 20 people to a conference. And you've suddenly got 20 people going over that little piece of bandwidth from Buenos Aires back to your data center. So you do need to think about the impact of providing local numbers. Because suddenly that audio traffic, that dial-in, is going over your wide area network. Yes, you can gauge that and guess what the concurrency is going to be, but just be aware of it, particularly for smaller offices, because that's where the ratios tend to be quite different. It says region on here. Is the region Australia or is the region Australia Melbourne? The region is Australia Melbourne. All it is a text field. What that text field does is I have one against me as a user. So when I create my meeting, it will put in the right phone number by default for me. That's all it does. It's nothing clever. It's just a way of ordering those numbers and for automatically putting the right one in for a particular user when they organize a conference. Languages. You notice there are a number of different languages. You need to think what languages you're going to provide. Do you provide the primary language for that country? Or do you find the provide the default language for your organization. You know, we in Microsoft tend to expect everybody to speak English. We're pretty bad at that, really. Well, that's not actually quite true, because if you go to some of our countries, Austria's on there. I've got friends in Austria. Most of them speak Austrian. It says German there, because we don't do an Austrian language back. It's very similar. They get away with it. So you need to think about what language. And sometimes you might have, like Vienna, two different numbers. One for each language. You can provide multiple languages on the same number. The user gets the options to change language. What does it mean? That personal virtual assistant I put in, that's the bit that uses this predominantly. It can give you announcements in your own language. It can tell you things in your own language. If you want to do help, it will give you all the DTMF tone information in your own language. So it's very useful. You need to think about PIN policy. One of the things on that page, Darling Conferences page, is sign in. I, as a user, can sign in and change my PIN. What's that PIN used for? That PIN is used for me to authenticate, not for people I'm inviting to the conference. It's used for me to authenticate. So when I dial into a conference, I can be an authenticated user. It will show up as me. All right? And all I do is type in my extension number and my PIN. That comes to the last line. You need a line URI. Whether you are enabled for enterprise voice or not, if you want to do dial-in conferencing and PIN authentication, you need to populate the line URI. You don't have to enable the user for enterprise voice, right? Because it's that extension equals that when I dial into dial-in conferencing, and it says, are you the organizer? Press star, yes, press star. I can type in my extension number, 3291, and my PIN. I mean, best the thought you're all having is, 3291's great, but aren't there loads of those in Microsoft? Yes, there is. The system is clever enough to make sure that all those people with 3291 as their extension number don't have the same PIN. All right? So it knows that mine's a six-digit PIN. Those 10 characters I type in are unique to me. Okay? Yes, in theory, somebody could accidentally type in the wrong PIN and match somebody else, but actually, the number of people with 3291 as an extension is quite low. It's just not going to happen. You could randomly type in digits just as easily. So that's how dial-in conferencing works and how I authenticate. Why does authentication matter? Come on to in a minute when I look at how you join. Conference ID. There's a join. That's mine. It won't help you if you write it down. That's not my default one. I generated that one automatically. So why do I generate one automatically? I have a default conference ID. One, if I just meet now, is always the same. If I change the invite settings, it will change the conference ID and make a unique one. The reason for that is in the conferencing database, it knows what the settings are for every single meeting. And that's why I can use a default one, because the settings are always the same. The conference directory. This is a component that most people forget about, particularly when moving between pools. As well as the conferencing database, there's a thing called the conferencing directory. The conferencing directory is used to convert that alphanumeric code at the end of my join line, DFV4JVCP, to that numeric conference ID, 707-16233. It's an important component. You need to move it if you decommission the server. The other thing that's important about it is people say, can't I have a shorter conference ID? The length of that numeric conference ID is determined by the number of conference directories you have on a pool. Because actually that conference ID is made up of, the first digit is it's a reserved digit, I'll say that. The second two digits are generally the conference directory number. The next group of digits is the conference number, and the last digit is a check digit. If you look at the URL at the bottom, that will explain how all that comes together. By having more conference directories, I reduce the number of conference numbers within a directory. Hence, I can get that number shorter. So if you want shorter IDs, put more conference directories on a server. PowerShell commands tell you how to do that. You notice there's a join URL on my meeting page. The other thing you need to consider is your URLs, what's called the simple URLs. We document three different options. It's that initial join. For the meeting one, it's that initial join. So what I click on, what I see in that meeting invite. And of course, you never click on a link, do you? You always type it into a web page, don't you? Yeah? So it wants to be rememberable. You know, if you make it something hieroglyphic like well, it used to be in Office Communications Server, it's not easy to type into a web page. Yeah? That's why we have them, because people want to do the right thing. So that meet URL, you've got three choices. The impact of the different choices is really around DNS and certificates. And that's what makes a difference in which one you pick. You can change them after you've set them if you want to. There are implications of doing so. You need to think about it. Do look at the documentation. So what are the three choices? Well, the first one is the nicest option. Right? It's the nice, clean option. Meet.contoso.com, darlin.contoso.com, and admin.contoso.com. Right? It's much easier to type in and remember. The downside of that is it's three DNS entries, three SANs in your certificate, and if you're using external, on the external certificate, on the reverse proxy, it's two SANs, so you don't put the admin one in there. But every SAN costs money. Right? So there's a cost. It's nicer, there's a slight cost, depends on your organization. The one I typically see is the middle one, option two. And if you notice on the Microsoft one, that's the one we use, as actually meet.microsoft.com/meet. But link.contoso.com/meet/darlin for the darlin, /admin for the admin. Because it's one DNS entry, one entry in the certificate. The problem I come across is most customers struggle to know what to put at the beginning. They don't like putting link at the beginning. You know? Join is what I tend to say, join.domain.com. If you've got multiple domains, if you support multiple domains, then you have to create a meeting URL for each domain. And that's a SAN for each entry. And typically that's okay for most organizations with only two or three SIP domains. Option three is the one I tend to see for organizations that have got a lot of SIP domains they're supporting in their implementation. And this is because, again, it just uses one DNS entry, one SAN certificate. It does mean that the meet URL is slightly more complex, slightly longer. I've put domain in there like contoso.com/contoso.com. That's what we say. Reality is that middle bit, the second contoso.com or the fabricam.com, doesn't have to be the SIP domain as a name. Okay? But it does need to be relevant. So how does conferencing join happen? So that simple URL is what I click on, and it launches my browser because it says HTTPS in front of it. If you know anything about Windows, and Apple Macs, you know, those anything before a colon determines what program gets launched. So it might be Internet Explorer. It might be some other browser. But it will click on that. What that does is that talks through the reverse proxy to the link pool, potentially, and runs what we call the join launcher component that I spoke about earlier. That join launcher, based on what's in that request, because there are certain things in that request, knows whether you've got a link client or link attendee client installed on your machine. It will pass back a join URI. Now, it may either be for the web app at http:// or it may be a SIP:// because it knows you've got an installed client that understands SIP. The browser then launches that component, be that the link client, the link web app, or the link attendee client. That then talks, if it's the link client, to the link edge. If it's the link web app, it will talk to the reverse proxy for that web app. The link edge talks to link pool. The same thing happens internally. The same meeting URL. One of the things we've assumed is you've got split, what I call split brain DNS. You resolve your DNS queries differently internally to externally. So if I put meet.contoso.com, I get different IP address internally to externally. If you haven't got a split DNS for your main domain, your SIP domain, not your AD domain, then you need to do pinpoint DNS, all in the documentation. You need to make sure that that internal one doesn't try and go out and back in again. It can, but I've seen issues when people try to do it, depending on your proxy servers and what they allow you to do. Some don't allow you to do loop around. Very, very easy. There are different certificates. The pool certificate is different to the proxy certificate. The proxy certificate has the external web services name. The pool has the internal web services name. The meeting URL, you need to consider which pool is going to host that meeting URL. I have one meeting URL for my whole organization, or for each domain. Well, hold it, I might have servers in America, in Europe, and in APAC. So which one's going to service the meeting URL? You need to make that decision. You can point proxy out either the server or a director, doesn't matter which one, but you don't have to do it once. One of those implementations. It is only the join launcher that will go through that particular edge. Even if you're using a web app. Because as I said, the join launcher looks at the meeting URI, works out your what capability you've got, and passes back a different URI, the one for the actual pool hosting the conference. Right? So you'll get redirected to the appropriate edge for the pool that's hosting the conference. So it's not as if everything's going to go through the same edge. Only the join goes to that one edge. So you've configured all that. The other thing you consider is the meeting invites. What are people going to be allowed to do? On the left-hand side there is the meeting options you'll see in Outlook. There's a default settings. That's not the default settings. I've changed them to get that up. I've clicked Customize. You can design who has access automatically. Who gets directly into my conference? I've said everybody. Ooh, maybe not a good idea. That means an anonymous user gets straight into my conference, whether anybody's in it or not. People dialing in bypass the lobby, and I'll talk about that in a minute. It's an interesting setting. It's an option within any one of those. Presenters, it's an interesting one. Default setting, people from my company are automatically a presenter in my meeting. What does that mean? Well, how many of you have dialed into a conference and you've sat there waiting for the leader to join before you can have the conference? Yeah? Well, as long as one person from my organization is authenticated, they're automatically a presenter. And automatically can let everybody into the conference. It's a bit like going to a meeting room. Do you all wait outside until the leader comes? Or actually, if you're a guest, you're waiting in the entrance reception for the organization, you can be picked up by anybody in that company who's part of that meeting. Same idea. Now, I know some organisations want to know. Generally, having on as default is okay, but you may have some meetings where you don't want that. And that's when the meeting options come in. You can come and change them for a specific meeting. You've got certain meetings where you don't want that to happen. There are some global settings, the bits on the right. So you can set some default settings for people. What is the default going to be for conferences? When they say, so you can set some default settings. So what is the norm in your organisation? Okay? So you can set meeting configuration. So you can define whether you want people to, by default have company as presenter or not. So what happens? Well, when you join, you may or may not go into the lobby. The lobby is there to hold people until somebody who is authorized is in the meeting. So it may be that you're waiting for the meeting leader, because I said only the meeting leader is a presenter. You'll all be waiting for him. PSTN bypass. One thing to be recognized is if you're used to audio conferencing, it's not as obvious as that people are in the lobby, right? And if you're in an audio conference and you're the leader of that conference, the last thing you want to have to be thinking about is whether people have come in late and gone into the lobby. So by enabling anonymous to bypass the lobby, you don't have to worry about that. If you're predominantly doing audio conferencing, it means those people get in automatically. But you have to be aware of that. As opposed to if I'm using the link client, I get a nice bar at the top, I can see people are waiting in the lobby, I just click the admit button and people get in. Pros and cons, but it's an interesting one. Just be aware of it though. And it does impact people within the organization as well. And the one that thing says, if I've got PSTN bypass and I said invites only, non-invited attendees can dial in still and get straight in. So PSTN bypass does have implications, just be aware of them. Another thing you need to consider is conferencing policy. This isn't the full set, this is what you get in the GUI, in the control panel. The set CS conferencing policy PowerShell command, there are some extra options on there. So do be aware of that. But the GUI offers you most of the options, things like what's my default meeting size going to be? Am I going to allow that person to have anonymous users or not? I have some customers who are security conscious, and they say, well, no, we don't want anonymous users except, of course, the execs. They always want to be able to invite anybody. Oh, and marketing. It's crazy how quickly you find it's almost everybody. Do you want to allow recording or not? Am I going to be able to record in that meeting? You can turn that on and off. You can allow participants to record or not. By default, they don't. One of the things about recording is there's that thing called a personal virtual assistant. If I've dialed in to a conference and somebody starts recording it, if I'm using the link client, you'll see a nice icon saying it's been recorded. I don't get that on a phone, but that personal virtual assistant will tell me in my language that it's now being recorded. One of the reasons we don't allow peer-to-peer calls to be recorded because the personal virtual assistant isn't running. So you can't tell somebody on the end of a phone. Do you want to allow audio and video? You may, when you come to do your network assessment, find that actually you've got areas with low bandwidth. And one of the things you might want to do is say, well, for users on that part of the network, I'm not going to allow them to do video. You start setting these sort of settings in here. You want to allow desktop sharing, all these other sorts of things, whole set of things. Application sharing. I'll talk about bandwidth in a bit. Application sharing and desktop sharing, they're two different things. When I share my desktop, this one's not too bad, it's not too high resolution. Not too bad. But how many of you have multiple monitors? So share my desktop. My resolution has just got very big. And it'll impact bandwidth for desktop sharing. Application sharing just shares that one application. So you need to think about some of that sometimes. So we're going to come on to network. You need to think about the network when you're doing conferencing. Some of you went to Brian's session talking about planning, and a lot of the stuff you see from us is around voice. Some of those things apply to video conferencing as well. You need to think about them from conferencing. You need to think about your WAN impact. You do need to do some traffic modeling. In fact, while I'm here, I've got one of my customers doing that as we speak. I'm doing a conference call later on with them. Network capacity planning. Think about your network. I said it is different to voice. I said you've talked about half your people being outside. That has an impact. There are some controls, quality of service, call emission control, those user policies I showed you. You've got ways to control things. So when you're planning, like any good plan, think about the number of users on a site. Think about the modalities they're going to use. Are they going to do application sharing, desktop sharing? Are they going to do video? You may have a mix of users. You may have some users who don't do conferencing. All they do is IMM presence. Yeah, still think about them. You need to think about your network topology. Available bandwidth. Notice that available bandwidth, not total bandwidth. Think about known bottlenecks. If you talk to your network teams, they generally know where the bottlenecks are. They know where the issues are. If you've already got issues, you're not going to make them better. Think about what QoS policies you've got in place. I'm sure Brian showed. This is bandwidth figures. Different codecs are used in different environments for different clients. So, in conferencing, typically we use G722. Oh, what happens if I'm using communicator client, communicator, not link, connect to an audio conference? It's going to use Siren. Because it doesn't sound G722. So you need to be aware of some of these. It does matter. G711, PSTN darling. I'll try and use G711 if I can. Video. So what size video window am I going to have? For conferencing, you have a choice of SIF or VGA. SIF is that nice little window. VGA. Well, first of all, you have to make sure you size the window big enough to warrant VGA, and a lot of people don't. And you have to have a machine that's capable. So you've got to have at least two cores. And you suddenly realize most people aren't going to do VGA. Depends on your organization. High definition I've left up there because that's predominantly for peer-to-peer. You need four cores for high definition. So you need a laptop a bit like mine with an i7 processor or an i5 processor, four cores. And, I'm at home. That bandwidth figure for high definition is 1.2 meg. How many of you have broadband at home? And if I asked you, I bet you said you've got something like 20 meg broadband or 40 meg broadband. Do you know what your upload speed is? ADSL generally is 512K. So that 30, 40 meg broadband now doesn't sound quite so good if you want to do high definition video from home. I have BT Infinity service, so I actually get 10 meg upload on mine, so I can do high definition from home. But you need to be aware of that. Surprising what people don't know. How many of you spotted the one on the right hand side? Application sharing, up to 10 megabits. How many of your organizations are worried about video and think nothing about application sharing, desktop sharing? Yeah. It surprises me. Application sharing uses more bandwidth than video and nobody cares about it. Because people see the benefit of doing it. Right? People see it's a great thing. So they think video is a nice to have. Video's not a nice to have. Video changes your meeting experience. How many of you sat on an audio conference when you're the person remotely and everybody forgets you're there? Your video's on screen, they don't forget you anymore. They include you with what's going on. That's good. How many of you sat on an audio conference at home drinking your cup of tea, coffee, whatever. Yeah? Doing something else. Oh, you put your video on and you suddenly start concentrating on that meeting. It makes a difference. Make people aware of the benefit. If they see the same benefit from video as they see from desktop sharing, people won't worry about the bandwidth. And it's not as bad as people think. There is one thing about applications. I said up to 10 meg. The problem with application sharing is it is different from video. Video is a fairly consistent bandwidth. Application sharing, by its nature, is bursty. It does vary. Multiple monitors do make a big difference. You know, it increases substantially. If you've got a lot of multi-monitors in your organization, you may want to think restricting to just application sharing. The downside is your help desk won't want you to do that because they like desktop sharing to be able to help people out. Okay? There are ways to make that work by making sure they organize the meeting and things like that. You can get around it. But just be aware of it. So I'm going to quickly go through some of the bandwidth calculator. Ooh, he says. We hope it all works. Try again. Oh, perhaps I pressed the right button, didn't it? Sorry, we changed which button it was on. My fault. User error. Come to my session this afternoon and learn about user errors. I'll tell you loads of my user errors. Bandwidth calculator. I know Brian showed this in his session. I'm just going to go a bit briefly then because of that, for those that weren't at Brian's session. So bandwidth calculator, we produced this. And it's surprising, most people think it's about audio. It's not. It covers all the scenarios. Okay? So if you're doing conferencing, whether you're doing enterprise voice or not, if you're doing conferencing, go to the bandwidth calculator. There will be things you do differently. Not much, though. The bandwidth calculator is an Excel spreadsheet. It's nothing rocket science. Wow. A little bit. It's just doing some basic calculations in the background. It's using those bandwidth figures, working out concurrency and various other things to give you a calculation. There's nice big buttons on it. If I zoom out, actually. There's nice big buttons on it. Start here. It steps you through. It steps you through, step by step, the things to do. You don't have to go through it in order. I don't. I'll explain why. But you do want to do things. If you click on each of these buttons, it will take you to the right page, and there's a button there to get you back. So the first thing we do is to configure some global parameters. These are these figures up the top here. So we'll do want to display my bandwidth in kilobits, megabits, or gigabits. Depends on the size of your organization. Generally, it's megabits for most people. Some people are different. Flag in red when WAN usage exceeds a certain percentage. I talked about available bandwidth. We'll come on to that in a little bit. So you may have a 100 meg link, but the last thing you want is for your conferencing to take up all 100 meg. So typically 30%, we said, you know, if we said anything over 30% starts to tell me I'm using a high percentage of any one link, yeah? So just saying, is the amount we're using particularly high for any one link? Yeah? Because that's a red flag. It's just saying, we just need to double check if we've really got enough bandwidth, what's it going to do with everything else that's on there? Codec behavior. I put typical. I tend to start off with typical. I want to know roughly what it's going to take. Because I tend to start thinking without call emission control. If you're using CAC, then you may start setting other values elsewhere. You know, what's the maximum? Maximum with folder error correction, those sorts of things. I do have those choices. But normally I'll start with typical. And then my application sharing resolution. So what's my desktop? Now, we haven't got every single resolution there is. We've just put some of the main ones in there. You can change those, and I'll show you where in a minute. But you select your typical. What's the typical desktop resolution you see in your organization? Select the one. So when you're doing desktop sharing, it uses the right bandwidth figure. And then that's a nice button to return to start. Now, its next two sets says define central sites and define branches. I normally skip those two steps and come back to them. Right? What they're actually getting you to do is go to the central site page and just define the site. So what are your central sites? They may be your three data centers. At this point, all you put in is the WAN link speed for that site onto your backbone, onto your WAN. And how much is allocated for RTC? So I said you might have a 100 meg backbone, but your network people said you can only use 10 meg for RTC. Okay? So that's where you'd put that in. You say, what is my configured amount I'm allowed to use? And that's all you do at this stage. You don't do all the stuff to the right-hand side that we'll come back to in a minute. And that's why I tend to skip it and do the other two steps, next steps, and then come back to it. But if you step through the guide, that's what it tells you to do. And it tells you to do the same for branches. And then we go on to usage models. This takes you to this page. So there are a number of things. The usage module up the top right here. This is the usage model we've used, A, to do server scaling figures, and B, to within this. This is what we typically see, you know, having done this with thousands of organizations, this is what we've seen as roughly the sort of mix that we see when we talk about a low user, a medium user, and a high user. What percentage of those users are online at any one point of time? So medium, about 80% of users in an organization will be online for IAM presence at any one point in time. Now, your user organization may be different. I deal with a number of police forces who have shift workers. Their ratio is quite different to that because of the nature of their business. Yeah? So be aware of that. Sometimes it is different. But these are typical figures for most generic organizations. So again, how much peer-to-peer audio is going on, how much peer-to-peer video. So we still use that high-definition figure in peer-to-peer video. Conferencing audio, conferencing video, desktop sharing, PSTN audio, that sort of thing. So you define you can vary these if you want to. My advice is don't vary them unless you've got some real statistics that you know your organization is different. Okay? All right? Like most models, they're a best guess, but if you have data that says you're different, change them. If you haven't, take the best guess. What you then define is what we call personas. You can edit these, you can change these. You can type anything you like in here. I'm not going to. But you can type your own. So you can put, I'm doing one at the moment for one organization, and we have some people who work in animal health. They're a government organization. They're responsible for, amongst other things at the moment, the horses coming to the Olympics. And if this is what modeling I'm doing at the moment. We're just rolling out conferencing for them. And because they know during the Olympics, their users are going to be more remote than normal. They're not going to be traveling much because of all the traffic because of the Olympics. So they want to do more conferencing, save people having to travel. So we one group of workers are animal health workers, and we define their profile. So you may have groups of organizations. Now, we only put about 10 options there. Why? For each site, you can only have 3 options. And generally, what I see most organizations, if you actually look generically, because again, you don't tend to have enough data otherwise, you end up with about 5 or 6 different profiles of different types of user. And what you're looking at is what capability they got. So, are they average sort of for IAM presence? Are they average for peer-to-peer audio, average for conferencing, average for desktop sharing? PSTN audio. If you're only doing conferencing and not doing enterprise voice, set that to none. These are your non-enterprise voice-enabled users. What type of video am I going to allow? SIF or VGA? What have I set in my conferencing policies? What I'm going to set in my conferencing policies? Remote. Average is about 10%, perhaps 20%. As I said, I've just done my health workers. We've set them at 80%. Because during the, we've just done modeling for the Olympics. During the Olympics, we're saying, yeah, we know 80% of them, they're going to be working from home, right? That's what we're modeling, yeah? That's why we're doing it. So it's quite unusual. But again, unless you've got something that says you're unusual, don't change it. Think about some of the standard figures. But do think about, you know, in Microsoft, you know, people who work in Redmond spend most of their time in the office. Not quite, but they're predominantly in the office. I work in the UK, which is predominantly sales and marketing and consultants. If I'm in the office, I'm not earning money. Right? I spend most of my time not in the office. So our percentages are quite different for sites outside Redmond to those at head office. So you do get different profiles. So just be aware, let's think about it. So create your different profiles. The other thing on here is minimum thresholds. One of the problems with conferencing is it's all based on concurrency. Concurrency is not an exact science. It's a best guess. And the problem is, small sites are the one that cause your problem. When you take concurrency, you know, for 1,000 users, it's quite easy to take an average. When you try and do that for 10 users, it's not as obvious. The variance is much greater. And therefore, we put these figures in saying minimum thresholds. So we've created these default ones, branch, small, and medium site, and roughly those sort of size and number of users. So we're saying for those, let's set some base figures. So we say, we're actually going to say for these sites, it's 100% for IAM and presence. You know, always 10, always 50, always take the maximum figure. Or we've done slightly different concurrency figures for some of the others. Again, to make sure you allow at least a certain amount. So effectively, I've gone through usage models, custom personas, thresholds, and now we get into data entry. Right? And this is where I would enter, for each site, I'd enter the site name. Yeah? For a particular site, I say, which site has provided those user services? So I work out of our Reading office, but actually, my conferencing pool is in Dublin. Yeah? So this is where I start modeling that. Have I got a local PSTN breakout? If you're doing voice, this is where you'd set that. Of course, if you're not doing enterprise voice, just set that to none. Again, I'm going to put my WAN link speed in. How much is I'm going to allow for RTC? Is it a small site where I need to put a threshold on? When I first start, I tend to leave this as a no, because sometimes this modeling happens more than once. I'll do an initial model, and then I'll go and start putting restrictions on. So if I know I'm going to be using CAC, then what does that mean? So am I restricting or go using CAC? Yes. That's going to start saying, I'm using different codecs. I've got fixed amounts of bandwidth. Yeah, it does slightly different things. And this is where I then put in my user profiles. So for any one site, I can have three types of profiles, and I say how many of each type of those are there. So I might have... So I can put those in. So it's simple as that, I put those in. Now I may have here, you might have, oh, I know some customers, I deal with some of them at the moment, I've got 500 branches. I don't want to have to put 500 entries into this spreadsheet. You don't have to. Branches like this, because often they're standardized. You know, they've each got 10 users on, they've each got a particular size of network. In fact, often what happens is I've got one, you know, they've got, you know, four different classes of branch. Yeah? So they know from their model. So what you put in is those different classes and say how many you've got of each. What it'll do is work out what the bandwidth is for that site, and it also works out what's the impact on the central site and the requirement for the central site onto the wide area network. Right? So if you've got 50 sites that require 1 meg, then it's going to put 50 meg onto the central site. So having defined all these, and go back to the start, and I'd again go to start. I'll show you one other thing before I do that. This is the other area that, caution, don't change these. These are where all those bandwidth figures that I showed you earlier are put in. So those bandwidth figures for the different types of codecs, this is what we put in. Why do I show that? Well, this is a link modeling tool. I've used it for OCS customers. Why? Because I can just change the codex values for the different bandwidths, because I know that actually in their case they don't use G722, they always use Siren, so I just set the G722 equal to Siren, it will do the same thing. So you can use it for other things. But the important one is that you may want to change desktop sharing. If you've got a standard desktop that's different to that, change one of those. Put yours in. Work out what the bandwidth figure is going to be for it, and the calculator will use it. So if we go back to here, what we finally do is eventually we end up with view the results. If I go to the results table, I can go back and change and update it. What this is going to show is for each central site, what is their bandwidth required? And what is the bandwidth available? And does the same for each branch. Just expand that slightly. Oh, I can't. So it's bandwidth available for RTC. What the graph shows, the graph is showing the comparison between the bandwidth required and the bandwidth you've specified is available for RTC. So if you've said it's a 100 meg link, only 10 megs available for RTC, then it will flag up there very quickly. And again, it does it for each of the branches. The other one it shows is this one, and this is much nicer because it shows it in red. The more red you've got, the more issues you've got. So this is also comparing amount of bandwidth against what you've said is available for RTC, and also against that 30% threshold on the total link. If you need to look at any details of any particular site, there is more details within the spreadsheet. You can see the different amounts for each type of modality. And that's quite important when you start looking at QoS. And seeing with the branch sites, you can scroll over, you can see the different amounts for each modality. So that's the bandwidth calculator. QoS, just mentioned very briefly. What's QoS about? QoS is around prioritization on the network, right? A little bit about bandwidth control, but it's mainly about prioritization. It's about reducing delay, jitter, and packet loss. We use DSCP markings. In a fully managed network, you may have different QoS buckets for different types of traffic. I was having a conversation down on the floor yesterday with somebody around QoS, and we're talking about actually putting the SIP signaling into a QoS queue, making a difference. Often people only think about the audio and video. They were seeing issues, and by putting SIP signaling into one of the QoS queues, they suddenly found those issues went away. So it does impact other things. It's based on port ranges. Look at the tech notes. I've put the links in the slides for you. Look at the tech note. That tells you exactly how to go through and enable QoS. Setting the different port ranges for different types of modality, both on the client and the server. And then using group policies to apply the DSCP markings. One note, if you're still running XP, it's different. You don't do it through group policies, you have to do it through registry entries, but all the documentation's there. Bandwidth controls. Conferencing policy. Conferencing policy is great. You can apply, in that set conferencing, it's not in the UI, maximum bandwidth for certain types of modality. So I can say that user's only allowed to use so much for video, irrespective of what they think they might have. Yeah? So there are policies there. But that's on a per-user basis. Media configuration, the max type of video allow. Are you going to allow VGA or not? Call emission control. It's audio and video only. Okay? Doesn't control the other things. It's applied dynamically, so what's available at this moment in time. So it controls the session limit, the network link limit. It's based on the link, not the user. So very good for your wide area network. Finally, briefly, I'm going to cover migration to coexistence. If you're how many people migrate from OCS to Link? Yeah? Okay. The Link server supports the live meeting client. If I move a user from OCS to Link, all their existing meetings carry on working. Okay? We have a backward compatibility component that runs on the Link server. So if the client's not updated, they carry on working, that's because it uses Meet colon. Meet colon launches the live meeting client. That's why it all works. When you update the client, though, what happens? Well, when I update the client, as long as I've left the live meeting client on their machine, their old URLs will carry on working. When they schedule a new meeting, they'll have the new URL, the new simple URL. And their new meetings will start using the Link client. In a mixed environment where you've got half your users with the Link client and half with the communicator and live meeting client, irrespective of which server they're on, which client is used? It's based on the meeting invite. If it's got the old style URL, it will use the live meeting client. If it's got the new simple URL, it will use the Link client. Or if I'm not on Link yet and I've got the communicator client and live meeting client, it's going to launch the Link web app for those users. Oh, the Link web app doesn't support audio and video. You need to think about that. Sometimes you may want to deploy the Link attendee client. There is an option, it's hidden away in a PowerShell command, to enable them to use the communicator client. The only time I tend to enable that is if they were using OCS primarily for audio conferencing, not for meetings. Yeah? Because that enables them to join because they're used to just an audio experience. So to summarize, you need to understand your requirements. You need to think about the clients, where people are located. You need to think about which features you want to control. My advice is don't control them unless you have to. Work out the bandwidth first. It's surprising. Audio and video is not as bad as people think because the concurrency levels are not as high as people think. Do model your bandwidth. You do need to be aware of it. And do think about migration and coexistence. And it is all around user experience. It is about what is my using, what app am I going to use at any one point in time. And sometimes it's worth doing a quick migration, getting everybody over, and deploying the client quickly. But I know I'm doing one at the moment with 30,000 users in an organization. It isn't going to happen quickly. Yeah? So do take care. Right, any questions? Do remember to fill in your evals. I'm sure you've seen these far too many times. I've put links in the slide. If you download the slide, the links are in the slide. I put them there deliberately. Most of them are off TechNet. First question.
Yeah, my question surrounds how do you keep track of, there's lots of monitoring tools and PowerShell commandlets. You can look for the, to monitor the environment. Well, what should you be looking at to keep track of, you do all this planning, but how do you make sure that your environment is healthy?
The main thing, there are a couple of tools. So as well as the monitoring server, which is predominantly aimed around voice, unfortunately, at the moment. There is the bandwidth monitor within the ResKit. So if you're using call emission control, then you want to run up the bandwidth monitor within the ResKit and start looking at actually how much is actually being used. There's also within the ResKit a bandwidth, you can turn on logging for CAC as well. And there's an Excel spreadsheet where you can import that data and actually see how much of your... So you can actually see how much video and audio is being used.
Okay.
Next one at the back.
Do you have a calculator about the load that Link puts on an exchange?
Right. Load put Link put on... I don't have a calculator. There is a white paper. I think it's about 1.2 clients on your CAS. Per user.
1.2
clients on your CAS server, I think is roughly what it is. There is a white paper on, if you look on NextHop, there's an article about link load on Exchange.
Okay.
It's about 1.2 clients per user. Yep, at the front. Yeah, go on, just talk. It'll work.
Right, okay. My question is about simple URLs usage in a global deployment. So you did not mention any usage of regionalized simple URLs.
Sorry?
Regionalized simple URLs with multiple regions, multiple...
Oh, right. So can you do them by site? You can do them by site. I've actually discussed that. I've only discussed that once with the customer, decided not to. And this comes down to which URLs you're using. So it is only the join that does it. And what I tend to find is actually what happens is for global deployment, often they're using different domains. And the domains go across the region, so you can actually point the simple URL by domain. Microsoft, we just let it happen, because all it affects is the join launcher. So you tend to put it in your one site. There's very little benefit of actually doing it separately.
So do you mean that the multimedia stream will find the best path depending on where the client is and where the edge servers are?
The meet URL is purely... The join launching process. Once the client connects, it's connected to the right edge server where the meeting's hosted.
Is it ICE that find the right
yes.
path?
So for the media, it all uses ICE, yeah. Okay. So it doesn't affect anything other than the join launcher. Okay. That's why you don't tend to need to do it.
All right, thanks. Two other quick questions. So you mentioned meeting recording.
Currently, speak up a little bit.
You mentioned meeting recording. Currently, there is no way to control who in the conference is going to be able to record, if I'm considering only authenticated users. If the organizer has the recording capabilities enabled, all the participants will have the same capability. Is there any way to restrict that to allow only the organizer to be able to record? I'm pretty sure no. And if not, is it going to be a feature that will come?
I thought it was only presenters could. I think it's only presenters by default. Is it any authenticated user?
Everyone, yeah.
No, then is the answer. I haven't seen anything.
Okay.
I thought it was only presenters. It's only presenters.
No, it's not. I can.
No, it's only presenters.
20 bucks.
And it should only be presenters. But the problem is, anybody who authenticates mm-hmm. is made a presenter. So if you turn off that, they mm-hmm. then become attendees, and they don't get recording by default.
Need to double check that, yeah.
Yeah. Next question. We'll try it in the lab in a bit, if you like. Yes.
On your gateway, I guess.
I'll try to think. Because we can disable it for audio. Yes, I'm guessing it uses the same setting as audio. So that's because it goes over the RTC stream. Then yes, you can turn it off. Yes, DFS, you can have DFS for high availability, yes. I will be down on the floor if you want to come talk to me later.